You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another 3CR Gardening Show. I am Stephen Wells, and today I have the honour and pleasure of sitting in the chair because I've been warmly welcomed to join our wonderful host team. I'll be familiar to some of you as I've sat on the other side of the bench in here before.
Just once or twice, Stephen.
Yes. I'm a horticulturalist, horticultural therapist and gardens coordinator. But that's enough about me. Today I am joined with a wonderful group of people. We have with me today, as I am learning, I have my actual learner's plate in hand as I'm learning, which is wonderful. But today I have, we have in here John Arnott, one of our regular 3CR Gardening Show hosts, recently retired from full-time work.
From full-time employment, yes.
Horticultural consultant, all-time botanic gardens and horticultural expert, passionate member of the Friends of Cranbourne Gardens, and you will be my licensed driver supporting me today. So welcome, John.
That's right, safety net, I think it's called. Good on you, Stephen. Thanks for jumping in, mate. It's really wonderful.
It is my pleasure. We also have Kate Archdeacon. Lovely to have you here. You're from Maribyrnong City Council, and you're the program coordinator of the My Smart Garden program and an esteemed potter as well.
So good welcome. To be here. Thanks, Stephen.
And we also have Stephen Ryan, who many of you will know, and if you don't know, you haven't been listening to 3CR for the last 20 or 30 years that's been.
Yeah, something like that. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So you know that Stephen's from Dicksonia Rare Plants, also with Matthew Lucas, the horticulturist on YouTube channel, so check that out as well. And guide for the ASA cultural tour, so yes, all of which we'll enjoy chatting with today.
Good.
Great to have you all in. How have you all been?
Good, Stephen. Really well. Really well. I'm actually a little bit croaky, so, but that's
fine. Have you been partying?
No, I wish. No, I wish much more bland, just a little bit of a... I'm not contagious.
Yeah, no, that's okay. You don't look it.
No, just a bit of a croaky voice this morning. But good.
Well, as I was jesting in my own mind, I was thinking I might introduce myself as just confirming that it is not 2 a.m. with the deep midnight, late night call voice, but maybe it's that deep croaky voice instead that's...
Doing the Barry Manilow thing.
Yes.
We've all got our voices for radio on this morning.
Yeah, I think we do, yes, indeed.
Definitely.
So I'm very interested to hear about each of you and how you've been and what's been happening in your world. So, actually, Kate, what's been happening in your garden?
I put in a mushroom patch yesterday, so I got some wine cap mushrooms, and I happen to have a big pile of mulch, hardwood mulch, in my driveway, as you do. So that took me about 5 minutes to do. I'm excited about that. But the other funny thing that's been happening is I've been keeping an eye on my pomegranates and wondering when they're going to be ripe, because they've only been fruiting for about the last 2 years, and I'm always a bit curious. Anyway, I was looking at the biggest one yesterday, and I can confirm it was ripe because it has been completely hollowed out.
Oh, gosh, yes.
What do you think? And now it looks like a very beautiful bauble or something. I haven't even seen...
A little gourd.
Yeah, so hollowed out all the way through. Yeah, it's still on the tree.
If it's still sitting there and you thought it was actually still doing its thing, how big is the entry hole? Like, what's come in and eaten?
It's Well, the pomegranate itself was probably
cricket
12
ball size?
Bigger. Yeah, bigger. probably 12 centimeters by that size. And so the hole is probably 8.
Four. So it was something substantial.
In one side and out the other, or in both sides. I mean, the honeyeaters are back, but that seems a bit excessive for a honeyeater.
Well, that's a feast if it's a honeyeater.
Hang on. I'd bet on a rodent or something.
Yeah, I was going to say rat.
Really?
Or possum.
It's still what?
Yeah, they're good climbers.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, well, good on them. Now I know. When I think it's ripe, it probably is ripe.
Don't discount them.
Yes, you've got to be first in, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I've got at the hospital gardens, we've got some apples and a very small amount. We've got the ballerina ones, but literally know when they were ripe because that's similar thing happened. You go, oh, they were there last week, and then the local possum clan come in and clear it out because they've been sniffing it and
they know.
They got
the sugars content level that they're happy with and they hit. So it sounds like it's happening at your place too.
Yeah. So much of our garden is for all the local wildlife.
Yep.
We try not to interfere in what's happening, although I have been fortunate enough not to get possums yet.
Okay.
Give them time.
Yeah, they'll find us, no doubt.
What's your address? We'll make sure we don't let them know.
Drop them off.
Yeah. You're western suburbs?
North.
Northern
on
suburbs.
The way to up in Campbellfield kind of way. Yeah, up in Faulkner.
Right.
Yeah. So not a huge amount of connected up habitat.
Very good. Very good. I'm sad to hear that you're not having pomegranate. On your dessert plate tonight?
That's okay. Look, I do think that we've kind of nailed the human food systems and maybe need to start practicing like the other species' food systems a little bit more so we're not
as long as they leave us something.
That's right. There's another 2 pomegranates still coming.
Yes, I don't mind sharing. It's when I don't get any that I get a little bit upset. But then you've got to turn around to yourself and say, all right, well, I have to contend with possums. I have to have parrots and cockatoos and things around. I've got all this wildlife around. Isn't that fabulous? And isn't it lucky I don't have elephant?
Or goats.
Exactly. So you've just got to look how lucky you are, potentially.
It's true. I will just throw in a few of our My Smart Garden councils have just successfully done a net swap program funded by DECA as well.
Ah.
So there was funding to replace the illegal fruit nets and give residents the new ones and have the old nets upcycled as well into new materials.
Great.
So I think they're planning to do that again. But that's been a great initiative.
Yeah, I think it's awesome because if we can do buyback schemes for other non-desirable things, then surely we can have programs like that for actual
things that help gardens and gardeners and wildlife. Yeah,
great.
So the non-conforming, non-code, is it about aperture size?
Yeah, if you can fit your finger through or even the tip of your little finger through the gap
through
in the
gap.
Net, then it's too big. Yeah.
Very good. Very good.
That might save a few bats as well.
That's what correct. It's all, yeah.
Bats and birds?
The flying foxes are really struggling with it.
Yeah, poor things. I have a soft spot for bats. Some people don't, but I think they're fabulous creatures.
Do you have them in your garden?
I have lots of micro bats, but not the flying foxes. They haven't found their way to Macedon yet.
Not yet.
But, you know, I wouldn't mind if they did. I mean, I find them fascinating creatures. I was one of those that stepped up when the bats were being pilloried in the Melbourne Botanic Gardens.
Oh.
And I was on the bat side, much to the annoyance of everybody else.
I was at the Geelong Botanic Gardens at the time when they were dispersing the bats from the Melbourne Gardens. I remember hearing that sort of chirp, chirp, chirp of some bats, some grey-headed flying foxes.
Yeah.
And we went out and there was 4-5 individuals. 5 days later, 12,000.
Well, they invited their friends. They realised there was a lovely place to live.
But that's, I mean, that's complex communications at a whole of camp level.
Mm.
So I think what they do is they send out scouts.
Yeah.
So these 5 scouts, they reported back to the main camp saying, I think I found something pretty bloody good. You know, it's got green grass, big trees, canopy. It's a little bit like home.
Yeah. Well,
come and check it out.
Lyle Philippe down at Rorama Nursery has a colony of fruit bats.
Right.
And that's only just down the road from the Botanic Gardens in Geelong. Mm. So, yeah, they wouldn't have had to come far.
No. They are amazing animals. I mean, they're pushing into Western Victoria, into South Australia. You know, their traditional range has, you know, got much, much bigger in the last 25 years.
Yeah.
Probably out of necessity.
They're still looking for habitat. That's the thing.
Well, there's the massive colony just on the Yarra River, just in edge
Horseshoe
of
Q. Bend.
Yeah, yeah. The Bellbird Park around through there. You can distinctively know as you're coming into the city on the freeway when they're there, particularly if it's just rained, because the smell of the bat colony just sort of wafts over the eastern freeway. But that whole area there, it's been there. They've been there for a while.
Yeah.
Isn't guano like a really useful fertiliser?
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah, yeah, yes. Yeah. Yes. Very useful. You've just got to keep telling yourself it's useful.
A little
But they are really remarkable. Yeah. And, you know, ecologically, they're the great pollinators of correct. Forests and dispersers of seed, and you know, they play a really important ecological role.
They do.
And the reason that we've got this kind of urban spread of grey-headed flying foxes is about habitat loss.
Correct.
You know, they're adjusting.
Well, if they moved into my garden, that'd be fine because we do Halloween at our place, so they could join in.
Just put the word out for them and say there's an invitation for this period. If you'd like a weekend
to early part of October.
Like a weekend holiday out of the city, come.
Do the full immersion.
Yeah. We pride ourselves in scaring the hell out of small children on Halloween night. I don't know. Well, I do know how it started, and it's become a nightmare and I can't get away from it now. But we have hundreds of kids that come to our garden. On Halloween, it's just ridiculous.
Because it's known as a
it's the place to come. Well, because my partner and I put a lot of effort in, so you know, we dress up, we do all sorts of slightly spooky things. We have Rachmaninoff's Isle of the Dead playing in the background. So yeah, we put a lot of effort into it. Last year, Craig's mum had to dress up as Miss Havisham for our Halloween event. So yeah, we have a lot of fun.
You'd be disappointed if they didn't come, from the sound of it.
Oh, well, we would. I mean, it's fabulous. You hear small children say, "I got onto the veranda this year, Mummy."
Is that because there's so many that they have to line up to get on there? Or is the scariness of getting to the spooky house?
It's scariness of getting to the spooky house, but there is sometimes a queue, I have to say. We do quite literally have hundreds of kids that come by our place at Halloween.
Brilliant.
Much to the annoyance of a lot of the neighbours in the street who are not so engaged with the whole thing. But anyhow.
Do you do the lolly reward as well?
Oh, yeah. I buy great piles of jelly snakes. I can't get jelly rats anymore. They were fabulous.
Well, spiders would be good.
I need some input if anybody knows where I can get really interesting lolly treats for small children.
I
don't know how we started on this, but anyhow, sorry.
Well, we were talking about grey-headed flying foxes.
So speaking of the fact that you've been having a garden opening. Well, it's actually a way of having your garden open without having your garden open.
Well, I have to say the kids might not take much notice of the garden, but a lot of the parents walk the kids around for Halloween. And I know that the parents have a sticky as they come in and look around and see what the garden's doing.
See, that reminds me of an animated movie. You know that when you go to an animated movie, that yes, it's for kids, but there are adult context themes in there that you go, oh, the kids won't pick that bit up, but the adults will go, oh, gee, that's clever.
Yeah.
So you're doing that.
Well, exactly. I am teaching horticulture subliminally.
You're encouraging the adults and the parents, but subtly, yes.
Yes, yeah.
Bringing the next generation into the garden.
Our garden's fabulous for kids because it's one of those gardens that's just chock-a-block full of plants. And so there's these little tiny paths that wander everywhere. And the Easter egg hunt is always exciting. Kids love our garden. You know, they can just go hunting around, looking around and hiding and all that sort of stuff. So
excellent. Yeah. Very good.
I love that subliminal thing. The a few years ago, you know, we were looking at the Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria was looking at mission and vision. And one of the bylines was every interaction that you have with the Royal Botanic Gardens will increase your, you know, your plant literacy.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of by using opportunities.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting opportunities to, you know, talk plants.
Yeah.
You know, where you're doing that on, yeah, you're immersing people in
yes.
both.
Using any other thing I can to,
well,
to engage people
and
in
lollies chocolate.
Hot
yeah.
But just imagine, maybe in, you know, another crew of us, in 20 years' time, interviewing people and chatting, and someone goes, you know what got me into gardening?
Yeah.
There was this place that we used to go to yeah. for Halloween, and yeah. it was awesome. And there was over the years, I moved from chocolate to plant appreciation.
Yeah,
absolutely. I had a party at Ceres a couple of weeks ago, and one of the highlights was walking around with my friend's daughters. They're sort of 8 and 4, I think. And they asked me if we could walk around the community garden there. And they were pointing out the plants to me. And I know that they don't have a productive garden at home because they have a small property.
Yeah.
But the little one was telling me, oh, we grow corn and we grow tomatoes and we grow lettuce. And I looked at her dad and he was like, nah, not me. But it's at kinder.
Yeah.
And brilliant. So these, you know, these kids knew what everything was.
Thank
it was very,
God.
Very few.
It doesn't come in plastic packaging from the supermarket.
And they wanted to know all about the compost because they've seen my worm farm over the years. And they were just, you know, had to stop them from grabbing the chilies, you know, because that always goes wrong. But they were
experience
so engaged.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, they'll only do those things once.
I know, but their mum wasn't there and I didn't want to be blamed.
It is like that sort of domestic home vegetable growing. It might have skipped a couple of generations, but it's back.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Isn't it?
Mm. Definitely.
Yeah. Mm.
Which is great because there's been, you know, you look at the last 20 years, I would say, there's been a consistent with kitchen garden programs in schools.
And what did that start? 20 years ago?
Easily.
Easily.
Possibly even longer.
Yeah. That's Stephanie Alexander and
which I think
spin-off.
Which is great because I think, you know, I grew up in a country town, so not our primary school, but in our high school we had ag studies.
Yeah.
So we actually had a connection there. But then I think what's happened is that generation-ish has not then had it, gone, actually, we missed that. We want that for our kids because we didn't get that because it dropped off. And now we're back with that connection more prevalent, which
being
is great.
Being possibly the oldest person in the room, I can remember my primary school days at Mount Macedon Primary School, my old alma mater. we had a head teacher there who was an English guy and he was a passionate gardener and we actually did gardening.
Really?
In our primary school way back then. That was in the 1960s, early 60s, and we did gardening at primary school. I mean, we didn't have a set-up garden per se. We had shrubs and borders and things around the school, and the kids were expected to go out and weed and all that sort of stuff. And, he was very encouraging. We used to go on nature walks to look at things in the area.
Do you remember his or her name?
Yeah, Mr. Hartle, his name was.
Mr. Hartle.
Yeah, he's always stuck well in my head because my father started our family nursery when I was a 10-year-old, so I was immediately immersed in horticulture from that moment on. Dad had a willing slave, and so as a 10-year-old, I was, well, basically a smart ass, really, because I knew so much more than any of my compatriots at school about horticulture.
Yeah.
In hindsight, it wasn't seriously much, but nonetheless, I had more knowledge than any of them, and I was in like Flynn with all of that sort of stuff. And I can remember taking plants to school to plant in the school garden from our nursery. I can remember using Latin names for the things. and so it was, it was inevitable. I have to say, there was no way I was going to get out of it. But, you know, growing up at Mount Macedon too, I mean, I grew up amongst all those big, beautiful gardens up there.
Yep.
I mean, I took it in by osmosis. So, you know, I used to hunt around the big gardens, whether the owners knew I was there or not.
that would have been part of it. Stories you could have had.
It was fascinating. And a lot of the gardeners that were there at the time were, in fact, trained gardeners. They weren't sort of Jim's mowing or whatever. Mm. Some of them, in fact, had come from the old country and had been the undergardener of the head gardener and all that sort of thing and worked their way through. So I was right at the very end of that era, and a lot of those guys, and they were all men, a lot of them took me under their wing because I was showing interest. And I still remember there was a head gardener at a property called Cameron Lodge called Mac Gramont, and Mac took me under his wing, and we were walking around the garden one day, and it's weird, I remember this so clearly. He looked at a plant that was in flower and he said, "Stephen, that's Thalictrum dipterocarpum."
Wow.
I'll ask you about that one day. And I don't remember what it was, the next season it was in flower, but at some time it was in flower and I happened to be there with Mac, and he said, "What's that?" And I said, "Oh, that's Thalictrum dipterocarpum." I don't remember actually physically thinking about it after he told me the name, but it was there and ready to come embedded out when I needed it.
Yep.
By the way, it's an Thalictrum delavea, if anybody's interested. But that's what happened. And so, you know, those people sort of headed me in the direction. There was no way I was going to get it into something else, even if I wanted to be an astronaut or a fireman.
That is brilliant.
It is brilliant. Mm. I mean, you talk about, is it nurture or nature? In your case, it's both.
Oh, yeah.
But if I could just be indulgent for one sec, we went to Fraser Island, Gari, a couple of years ago, and I was talking to my little granddaughter and grandson, everyone who would listen to me, actually, about Angiopteris evecta, the king fern.
Ah, yes.
And we went and visited the king fern 2 or 3 days into the trip, and we jumped into the creek in amongst me and little Elsie. Elsie was probably 5. And there was a boardwalk, and a guided tour came past, and the guided tour was going, "And on our right here, we have the king fern. The king fern is blah, 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 blah." And little Elsie, she said, "Excuse me, the real name is Angiopteris."
That's fabulous.
Yeah. it's that same thing. And we're in the butterfly house years later, maybe 18 months later. And I've spotted an Angiopteris in the butterfly house at the zoo. And I've said, "Else, come over here, mate. What's that?" And she's looked at it kind of quizzically and she's gone, "Angiopteris." Mm. I thought, good girl.
Yes. Well done. Amazing. Good girl.
Well, if kids can learn dinosaur names, I think they can learn plant names.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I was just going to share the reason that I think that my little friends are so open to worms and getting their hands on my worm farm is when they were a bit younger, I bought them a kid's book, a picture book. Well, it's a story book, and it's called Goodnight Veggies. And the stages go through basically a worm going through a productive garden and saying goodnight to all the vegetables, but he goes under the soil, and so you see the above surface system, and then you see the root structure of all these different types of veggies and how they very grow clever in the soil and stuff. It's a really beautiful book. And at the end, when the worm goes to bed, and as my little friend reminded me, goes to bed with one sock on, you know. but then it pulls out to the scene and it's a rooftop garden in the middle of a city.
Wow.
Which is so interesting. So they've always been very urban, very city kids, and yet that knowledge is still translating out to what they're seeing in the – and that just gave me – that makes me so happy, you know, to keeps know that as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things that I'm interested in a bit more of late is chatting with people about what's inspired them to become gardeners, or who or what inspired, which is a bit of a theme coming through this morning.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is awesome.
So serendipitously.
It is, because the interesting thing about it is it often is key people, parents and or
grandparents,
family members, that are often the influence, positive, obviously in this context, of engaging, bringing people in, which I think is fantastic because we know that that's the case. But it's now also then about encouraging those who are adults to go, you know, if you engage with this and this becomes part of your activities and looking after the garden and the house and the garden context, it is literally by osmosis that the inspiration comes for others, the next generation, to be engaged, to see it, to
actually, it doesn't have to be tiny children either. I had a phone call the other day from a gorgeous guy called Tim, who, for whatever reason, he wasn't a horticulturalist, but for whatever reason, he decided he was going to volunteer at my nursery.
Yeah.
And so he did. And Tim used to come up once a week, and I'd give him tasks, and he'd go out and weed or block things back or tidy things up or whatever. And his wife is a veterinarian and she got a job up in Canberra, so they had to move away. And I hadn't forgotten about Tim, but, you know, there'd been no contact, so I hadn't thought about it for yonks and yonks and yonks. And a few days ago, I got a phone call, and it was Tim ringing me from Canberra. They're still living up in Canberra. And he said, oh, I've joined the International Dendrology Society.
Wow.
And he's seriously got himself into horticulture. And I thought, yay!
Yeah, that's great.
You know, that's fabulous. You know, and he was an adult, certainly, when he started volunteering at my nursery. And everybody loved him. He was really engaged with what he was doing and he was learning so fast. I mean, the plant names were just going in and staying there.
That's a good thing. Like, they can go in, but it's a skill to actually
keep them there. Yeah. I've got a T-shirt which I'll be wearing in the next few days because I'm taking a tour to Madeira in the Azores, and the T-shirt said, if you were a plant, I'd remember your name.
That
so
is a great
I'll be wearing it. I've got another one that says, I have the right to remain silent but not the ability. So we should have fun on this tour.
That sounds great.
Just thinking about people coming to horticulture late, some of the best horticulturists that we've got at the Cranbourne Gardens and maybe even in the sector are people that have come to horticulture as, you know, late career folks.
Yep.
Because that's exactly what they wanted. They've worked it out.
Correct.
I don't want to be the...
Accountant or whatever.
Yeah, or the parking inspector or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So they come with this just desire and passion and commitment and focus.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Well, that was essentially my journey. I mean, I'd had gardening green blood, as I like to refer it, with parents being market gardeners and orchardists and gardeners, but it wasn't necessarily my direction. I'd been nursing first, but it was, in my late 20s when I decided to go back and study horticulture. So it's, you're right, and that was the interesting thing that I observed in that environment of those that have decided later, it's a conscious purpose decision.
It's purpose-driven.
Because there's a lot of other things that need to be decided for that to happen, you know. How are you going to earn income while you're studying, you know, those kind of
factors
that make it that much more purposed and thought and planned. Yeah. Therefore... you apply yourself later in that career. It's not just, give it a go and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, no, it's hyper-focus.
Correct.
Mm. Yeah. Did you think that you would combine the nursing with the horticulture? Was that the trigger? No.
I was nursing and actually still I liked it, so it wasn't that I was wanting to leave it and go running. But I initially went into it with the thought of exploring into garden design.
Okay.
That was my interest. During the course, the idea of horticultural therapy came up in one of the lectures and a few of the others were like, oh, that's you, Stephen, because you're a nurse as well. And I'm like, no, but I'm kind of wanting to get out of that. So I didn't. But during the course, understood that I didn't necessarily want that to be the direction, the garden design solely. But then ended up, after a period of time, working out in the nursery, retail nursery world, back in at the hospital. Nursing, and then the evolution of the garden and horticultural roles that came through that over the years evolved. So it was really interesting that, yes, my initial vision was garden design and that's what I'm going to do. But then through a few different factors, it evolved, which is great. That's why you go and learn and you experience. And then, funnily enough, back in combining the two and...
Mushed it all together
and loving it. So... the great example I describe with that is that the garden path analogy, as in, you know, you meander down a path and then you might just meander off to another side and then you might come back and put one foot in front of the other on the path. So.
Exactly. And there's that thing, isn't there, when people sort of say, how did you get to where you are? It's not like you knew what the end of the path looked like, but you can only ever take the choice from the steps that are right in front of you, you know, either
unless
before
you're Stephen
or
Ryan.
We all have different journeys now.
I had no choice.
Yeah.
No, it was just, that was it.
You're hardwired.
Yeah, I was.
Yeah.
I mean, I was a 10-year-old doing cuttings, potting plants, weeding, serving customers.
Speaking of
that's a unique situation to be in. Like.
Yeah, and there was absolutely never any alternative for me. So right from word go, it was not only horticulture, but it was the nursery industry, which was my thing, because people tried to push me off in different directions, like teaching. I did a bit of part-time teaching at the Oakley Tech campus when Oakley it was Tech. There. After I'd finished my course, and I decided dirt was better than chalk. And also, I have to say, some of those apprentices back then, I'm sure they're different. Well, maybe they're not, but back then it was young people who were often forced by their employer to go to school because they were taken on as a horticultural apprentice because they'd been told at careers that they probably wouldn't have any chance of getting another job other than going into gardening. And so a lot of those kids actually weren't that interested at all. And it was like trying to draw blood out of a stone. I really hated it. It was awful.
Demoralising.
Money was good, though, at the time. But, yeah, it was...
I'm hoping that that system's changed a bit now and it's more directed through schools, as in... what direction do you think that you'll go in? What can we support you in? I'm sure it's a lot more difficult.
Well, I hope it is. I mean, there were some exceptions when I was teaching. I mean, I interviewed one of my ex-students only the other day for our YouTube channel, Michelle Oliphant.
She one of your students?
Yeah, right, Michelle was one of my students. And even back then, I looked at that girl and I thought, now there's somebody who's doing this because they really want to. And she ended up working in the Botanic Gardens in Melbourne. She was in charge of the government house gardens, and she now runs her own horticultural maintenance and landscaping business, and yeah, she's never wanted to do anything else. So brilliant. So I'm very proud of Michelle. I can take some credit for that. So there were exceptions, but most of those kids couldn't have given a damn, and I'd be really surprised if many of them actually stayed in horticulture. I think a lot of those kids probably didn't. They just weren't interested, which is sad. But, yeah, I hope it's a lot different now, and I'm sure it is. I mean, Chloe probably would say that her students are much more engaged these days.
Well, I imagine so. When we chat with Chloe next, and it'd be interesting to see. I have a feeling that a lot of those students are a little bit older too.
Yeah, it could be too.
As opposed to straight out of school, so there's different cohort there, but I'd be interested to learn a bit more about that. Well, you are listening to the 3CR Gardening Show. My name is Stephen Wells, and in the studio with me I have John Arnott, Kate Archdeacon, and Stephen Ryan. We are very happy that you're listening in as we're chatting away here, but we'd love to have you part of the conversation. So if you would like to join us, if you want to call in, the number is 9419 0155, or you can text us in. I'm sure you've got these numbers in your phones already, but the text is 0488 809 855. Just be mindful that on the text line we don't have the capacity to have photos. But if you want to send something in to us with photos and ask us a question, we do have our email, which is 3cr.gardening@gmail.com. Send that in to us, and in due course the following week we'll be able to... respond to that and give you some info. But we'd love to have you join us, and obviously if you're not listening live to us now, you're joining us on our podcast, welcome. We look forward to having you part of this now and during the week or over the coming weeks, because if you haven't connected with the podcast site yet, there's all of our previous shows that you can enjoy.
Going back something like 15 years.
That is amazing. Like you could
really... There's a potential binge.
Don't worry about, Lord of the Rings.
Just do gardening program.
Don't worry about the trilogy. Just go for the, what is a 15-year-ogy? Now, John, what have you been up to in your, well, actually, there's a couple of things. What's happening in your garden?
Yeah, I have a whole. I have too many plants to squeeze into too small a spot. The growing friends at Cranbourne had a sale a couple of weeks ago, and they've.
How much did you buy?
Oh yeah, too much. Too much for the space that I have. So, I'm looking at all of these little tubes and thinking, I might have to give some of these away because I don't think I can fit them all into my little garden. So yes, just yeah, so it's planting season.
Yeah.
You know, the autumn break and all of that. So we're in Bayside Melbourne. We're in grey, no organic matter, dry for 3/4 of the year sand. So there's a little window of opportunity where you don't have to do watering when you're yes. establishing plants. Yes. So yes, it's planting season for us on the grey sand in Bond Beach.
So what's in the planting tray?
Mostly native plants.
Yeah.
Mostly things, a lot of Western Australian things actually, because of that sandy, dry condition. So at the moment there's Guichinotias, a couple of Hakeas.
Yes.
And just some bits and bobs of wildflowers.
Yeah.
Yep. Going to try and grow kangaroo paws. Our garden, there's a little area where we put extra compost in. 2 or 3 square metres. So we're going to try and have a crack at growing some kangaroo paws.
What about a nice red tingle?
yes.
Yeah, that'd go well in a small garden.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Just doing some planting. And, you know, all the winter weeds are doing their thing. All the oxalisi and annual grasses are up and about. So, yeah, doing a bit of weeding and a bit of planting.
They have jumped... obviously, we had a bit of a drier summer, but then we had that good downpour that came, and then everything went alive again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, overnight almost.
Growth. Yeah. I know at the hospital we had some apple trees that then started blooming, some rogue blooms that you're going, which happened because of that environmental situation.
Mm.
But you're seeing them going... You're 6 months out. Like, what's
that's wacky.
Dear. Yes, I don't think we get many apples from those blossoms.
No, you know, we just enjoy the blooms as they...
Yeah.
Well, and weren't many, but there were just a couple. So it's interesting to see what happens in the change of seasons when we have the dry.
Mm. We did just do our olive harvest, and off 2 trees we got... we did this with the grandkids. We got... 874, I think it was, individual olives. We counted them. We counted them. As we were dropping them into the sink to wash them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
I just want to jump in. The Olives to Oil Festival is in full swing the moment. So you don't have to know how many olives you've got to drop them off. They weigh them. There's still a few drop-off dates happening around the place in Westside, and you can definitely find them on the My Smart Garden website.
But that's a serious thing.
Excellent.
It's a co-funded partnership. So okay. Hobsons Bay, Maribyrnong, Merribeck, and Brimbank all tip in.
Yep.
And Melton have given us a pickup the festival site this year, and I'm not sure how that happened, but that's fantastic to see it spreading out. But essentially, if you don't know, you can book a ticket to drop off your olives, and then the team weighs them. They don't count them.
No.
why not?
And then they get them pressed by a professional olive grove, olive processor.
Nice.
And then people pick up a share of their olive oil about a month later. I think the pickup is in July. So
fabulous.
All the details are either on the – if you look for olives to oil, you'll either find the series website or you'll find the My Smart Garden website. It's all going back to the series website. But it's a fantastic initiative.
Yeah, I was looking at that during the course of the week. And realize, quite impressed by the diverse, the wide collection area that was available for people. So that was brilliant.
Yeah, and just, you know, we get the photos and just there's so many happy people, you know, little kids and, you know, they're just like, and crates and crates, you know, massive, like forklift kind of pallet.
What volume
crates.
Do you get?
Tons, I think. Yeah. And this is an off year for some reason. I'm not sure if like all the olive trees in metropolitan Melbourne were planted at the same time, but you know how they're like biennial croppers.
Yeah.
Mm. This is a quiet year apparently.
Okay.
So last year and next year would be normally really the heavy cropping years. Yeah. But I don't know why they're all at this sort of, the majority is all at the same time.
Yeah, there you go. Might be environmental
thing. Aligned themselves or something. Mm.
But it's not a single variety. It could be all green, in. It could be small, it could be big, it could be black,
absolutely.
It could be green. Yeah,
yeah.
So. A true community of olives.
Yeah.
As in everything all in together.
Mm.
Yeah, great.
Mm, it's really good.
As I said, very impressed by the diverse or the spread of suburbs in that, which was pretty impressive.
And the logistics that go into it, you know, the teams are doing incredibly heavy lifting to just even know, you know, where you can have a site that can take a truck that can have that much weight and all the tickets and the booking. I know that the teams start meeting like 8 months ahead.
Really? It's a major event.
Yeah. Because they're fitting it into everything else that they do on a day-to-day basis.
The collective noun for an olive, a press of olives.
A press of olives.
Oh, dear.
Well done, John. That's good. That's good. That is good. Now, interesting, you said you're retired from full-time work, John.
Yeah.
So that then means that you're not fully retired, and I know that you're doing some work with Botanic Gardens and Andrea Proctor, because I was hearing her talk about what I'm going to ask you about. And I want to hear more about it, which is the Botanic Gardens in out of Darbo.
The Burrendong Botanic Garden and Arboretum.
Yes.
So
what's happening there?
Look, I retired about 18 months ago, but was always pretty committed to keep some skin in the game. Yep. And not long after I retired, I saw an ad for someone to run a living collections planning process for Burrendong. And I sort of put my hat in the ring for that. It was using something called the Botanic Gardens of Australia and New Zealand Living Collections Toolkit, which was something that I had quite a bit to do with in when I was at the Cranbourne Gardens. So I was familiar with the toolkit and put a submission in and it got up. I knew of the Burrendong Botanic Garden and Arboretum, but I didn't know about it. In the process of assisting them with writing the collections plan, I realised that this was a garden of national significance. It was the first dedicated Australian native plant botanic garden in Australia. Goodness. So it predated the National Botanic Gardens, Melbourne and Tasmania and Sydney, or Cairns, so they were all growing native plants, but to have a dedicated native plant.
Where does Maranoa fit into that? Because it's pretty old.
Yeah, 1902.
Yeah.
But it was Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah, that's right. It was initially, wasn't it?
Yeah. And it was private.
Yeah.
Up until, I don't know, the 60s or something.
Yeah, something like that when it was handed over to the council.
Yeah, Maranoa, yes. And that's been there were a couple. The National Botanic Garden started growing plants in 1947, but didn't open until 1970. But the founder, a fellow called George Althoffer, he was growing Australian native plants in the 1920s.
Goodness.
And he started a nursery called Ninthana, which is
I know that name.
Which
yeah.
is now still going.
Yeah.
So that was Ninthana in 1932. So an absolute pioneer, sort of ground zero for the cultivation of Australian native plants. And, the numbers, I had a look at their database, the numbers of species that have gone through the Burrendong Botanic Gardens over the years, 5,500 taxa. So 5,500 different species or different things in the Australian flora. So, Australia has a flora of 23,000, 25,000.
Yeah. That's a big chunk.
20%
of
the nation's
huge.
Flora going through this, and it was completely... completely run by the community, it was just this visionary, extraordinary visionary project. But what happened at Burrendong about 15 years ago, it was funded by Crown Lands, and Crown Lands pulled the funding for it and a whole number of other places in New South Wales. So it's been in decline ever since. It's quite confronting. It's almost a bit the lost garden of Heligan. Mm. It's the lost garden of Burrendong because it's rewilded in that 15 years. Lots of the collection has declined, and you have to push through thickets of weedy acacias and then you'll see a label of something that was there planted in 1964 or something like that. Just remarkable. So the Living Collections Plan is it's a guide to how to rejuvenate the Burrendong Botanic Gardens and Arboretum. So it's been a lovely project to be associated with.
Yep.
And like I say, a garden of national significance, which is halfway between Orange and Dubbo.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's been a really lovely project to be associated with. I've joined the Friends at the Cranbourne Garden, so I'm active with the Friends group and still pretty active within the Botanic Garden Network. So,
yeah, good.
At one point I was busier than what I was when I was working.
I hear that happens.
This is a bit silly. Just need to recalibrate a little bit here, aren't it?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah.
It's good. It's going really well.
And interested to know, when you step out of a role, particularly on a site like this, and which is not that dissimilar to, I think, in a lot of garden contexts like this, you've got a paid role, but then you step, you retire or you step out of that, but then you're still connected, but you don't kind of have that same position and or authority to make decisions. And
that's an interesting little adjustment. So you go from having authority to having influence.
Yeah.
And they're two different things.
Yes.
So, yeah, a little bit of adjusting there. That was, yeah. But, you know, all good. It's,
It's just the awareness of going, for you, but also for others, seeing you in a different role and going, we don't go and ask John, because that's not John anymore, but John, because he's beside me. Who do we ask? How do we ask?
The really, really terrific news is that the Cranbourne Gardens, Tex Moon, friend of the show, is the Director of Horticulture there, and Tim Sampson, another friend of the show, is the Executive Director. The Cranbourne Gardens and the RBGV are in very good hands.
Correct.
So that's, you know, that's really lovely.
Yep.
And, you know, keeping a strong amount of contact and with the team and all of that, it's lovely.
I think it's probably more on reflection. It's maybe more about your transition, moving out of roles into different roles, than others. When you've got people like Tim and Tex on board, and people just go would naturally default to that. But it's also then about you and going, oh, how do I move out of that mindset into the I'm a passionate friend, and I come and you tell me what you'd like me to do, because I'm not need to make those decisions.
Yeah, it is a transition, and the right time, right place.
Great.
It feels good. One of the things that I did do last year was help organise a national conference, and I was pulling together the program for that as a volunteer.
That's just a big effort.
Just keeping some skin in the game, which is lovely. And of course, doing the 3CR thing, which is a genuine joy.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Excellent. Stephen, I'm interested to know now, this is going to be a hard one for you, I am sure, but you'll sail through it. What is the most, in your garden at the moment, what are plants that are singing for you at the moment that you...
Yeah, look, I always see myself as a horticultural tart.
No.
So I don't I go into minor passions on a regular basis just because I suddenly meet a group of plants that I think, why haven't I connected with this before? And so I'll have a little bit of a spurt of I have to collect a few different species and have a bit of a collection of these things. Funnily enough, I think what I brought along this morning to talk about is actually a current slight passion.
Yeah.
And that's the gesneriads. And most people would know African violets and gloxinias and streptocarpuses and things like that, well-known flowering houseplants. But they don't realise just how big the family
the
is.
Group is huge.
And there's quite a lot of cold-tolerant, even cold-hardy species within the family thing, which of course are the ones I would have to concentrate living on Mount Macedon, for goodness sake. So,
yes.
I don't know. Ages ago, Craig Wilson arrived at my nursery with a piece of plant that he didn't know what it was.
Yep.
Said, "What's this?" And it was, in fact, an Aeschynanthus, which is one of the gesneriads from Asia, Aeschynanthus goretii. And I wasn't quite sure what I was looking at either, but me being me, once I've got something in my hands, I've got to find out. So I did the research, somehow or another worked out what it was, sent Craig a text message to say, yay, I found the name, it's Aeschynanthus goretii. He'd found it in an old garden up in the Dandenong somewhere that he worked at. And so I pinned it down. And then, isn't it weird how things just then tend to find a place of their own? Because it was only months later that another Aeschynanthus came my way, and this time it came to me via the Sydney Botanic Gardens. One of the staff members up there sent a plant of this down for me, thinking it would do better for me than it does in Sydney.
Yep.
And it has. And it's still probably officially Aeschynanthus affin Brachiartis. But, you know, it may be Brachiartis, it may be a new species, we don't know. It has these fabulous dark clarity red flowers on it. It has purple reverses to the leaf and the new leaves are all purple. Fabulous plant. And then I was off.
Had a new passion.
And so it sort of happens. And so I've gone down this sort of tunnel and things in Gesneriadaceae seem to be coming my way. a member of our local hort society arrived at a meeting only a couple of months ago with this big branch of something. And I said, what's this all about? And she said, oh, I've got this thing in a big pot. I don't know what it is, or in a hanging basket, in fact. And the storm we had knocked some big branches out of it. And I thought I'd bring them along because they're really easy to propagate. And if anybody would like them, they can take them home. So I took one of them home. And there is, in fact, the baby, or one of the babies. I think I've ended up with about 30 of them.
Right.
Yep. Only put in as cuttings probably about 8 weeks ago. Now in a little 4-inch pot and a couple flowering. Of them flowering. Mm. And it has this fabulous burgundy reverse to the leaf. And it's another genus in the Gesneriad family that comes from the South American area, so Ecuador, Bolivia, and all those sort of areas, generally up in the hills. And that's the other thing with these cold hardy ones. They're still from the tropics, but most of them come from up in the mountains, so they're reasonably cold hardy. And Nematanthus has some fascinating plants in it. There's a little orange one that they sell around the traps as the goldfish plant, which is quite pretty. Yeah, shiny, course. Dark green leaves, makes a nice hanging basket subject. So I took some of the cuttings home to the nursery and I thought, well, I'm pretty confident it's a Nematanthus, but I didn't know what it was. I've spent hours scrolling all sorts of Google searches and what have you, and I think I've come up with the fact that this might be a garden hybrid called Bijou. It certainly fits all the bills. So I've now got 4 species of Nematanthus, or 3 species in a hybrid potentially. I've got the Aeschynanthuses. I've got Ramonda that comes from the mountains of Europe that looks like an African violet but it's cold hardy.
Yeah.
So I'm slowly building this. Oh, and I've got Fieldia.
Fieldia, yeah, I was going to say Fieldia australis.
Yeah, one of our Australian ones that grows on tree ferns down in Gippsland and up into New South Wales.
Great, yes.
So it's a sort of a climbing thing that attaches itself to the side of tree ferns. Up through moss on the side of a daisy musk bush or whatever.
That's it.
I've been growing that actually for quite some years, but it was sort of one of those outlier things that I just had because it was a weird native that most of the native nurseries weren't bothering with. And I thought, oh, well, it fits my range. So I started growing Fieldia. And so this whole Gesneriad thing has sort of, well, snuck up on me and just happened.
Have you grown the Bowia? Because the Bowia just looks like an African violet.
It does. It's in fact, you would mistake it for some sort of strange African violet when you saw it. Now, I haven't tried it, but the lady we interviewed on our YouTube channel, Annette, who's part of the Early Morning African Violet Society and all that sort of thing, and we've done a story with her on growing African violets, and we did a story with her on growing Streptocarpus, and we did a story with her on Gesneriads in general.
Yeah.
She had Bowia, and it comes from somewhere up in northern Queensland, and she's grown it in a glass bowl, covered glass bowl, so almost like a terrarium type setup, and she sits it on a heat pad.
Mm. Right.
And she's apparently tried it several times before. This one's actually grown, and I think she said it was flowering or had flowered. Strangest looking plant, and it certainly doesn't look like most people's concept of an Australian native.
No, it sure does not.
It is the weirdest plant. So we only just managed to have an odd Gesneriad in Australia. I think I looked up 3 different genera. Apparently Bowie has got more than one species, although I've only ever seen one.
I just Googled it. It was 15 species, but 2 in Australia.
Oh, only 2 are our
2 in Australia,
own.
Right.
So they must go up into, Papua New Guinea and places like that.
Yeah.
Fieldia, I think, is on its own, though, isn't it?
Sure
I don't think there's any other species in the genus. So, yeah, I don't know what happened, but, you know, I did the same thing with tropical but high-altitude blueberries.
Right.
And I've got probably as good a collection as I'm going to get in Australia.
Yep.
Of things like agapetes from the Himalayas, dysterigmas from South America, dimorphothanthras from New Guinea and what have you.
Paphia?
I've now got the white and the pink paphia.
Nice.
So I've got a white-flowered version from Mount Finnegan.
Nice.
Which I'm very pleased to have. So paphia is sort of our Australian representative of that group, which was a long time included with agapetes.
Wow, and before that, Pentapterygium.
Oh, God, yes, Jesus. Pentapterygium, yeah. I sort of miss that name.
I know.
I like that name. So I always like some of those sort of somewhat lyrical botanical names that yep. once you get to know them really well, you're bound to get elected as president of the garden club.
Well, see, this is what I'm admiring here with the conversation is the years of experience. And coming back to your point, Stephen, about, you know, this has been from when you were...
Yeah, from 10.
In utero, probably, yeah, technically.
Yeah, yes, probably.
It's just becomes these... The language just becomes... Yeah.
Well, people often say to me, you know,
these names that others would be going, yeah. Oh my goodness, what have you just said?
Yeah, but part of it's the fact that when you're passionate about something, you want to know about it. So, true. Therefore, the jargon is something that you need to acquire. And would you trust a car salesman who said, I'm not sure what brand it is, but it's, you know, it's got four wheels.
It's red.
You know, so horticulturalists need to also pick up their game and run with being professional in what yep. we do. And so plant names are one of those things that I have a passion for and I try to keep up as well, which is really hard to do with all of the name changes that are going on at the moment. Yep. But I feel the need to, and I don't take it as a personal insult anymore.
Yep.
I take it like doing the morning crossword. Somebody tells me there's a new name, I'm going to try and learn it. I don't go, oh, I can't be bothered now, I'm too old to learn that name. You know, I do get annoyed, though, when they change them back. that annoys me.
Yes, yes.
That I don't like.
Stephen, just on the Gesnerids,
yeah.
The Tropical Mountain Plant Science Project at the Dandenong Ranges at the RBGV, there's another thing called Lenbrasier.
Have they got it? Oh, so, I have to have it.
So maybe
you said the magic word.
Yeah. Maybe put a line message through to text.
Yeah.
See if you might be able to pick up one of those.
I think I need to go and get a Lambrosia.
I reckon it'd be perfect in your climate.
Oh, good. Oh, there's a hunt.
Now, Stephen, we've got a text coming in from Susie, just wanting to check how you spell that plant. The one that you propagated from a tree branch was what Susie said.
It's, well, a nematanthus, so it's nematanthus, nematanthus.
Excellent.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a mouthful, but then they are. The form I've got here, I think, is bijou, but I've got nematanthus wettensteinii, which is the little goldfish plant, and I've got plants of nematanthus fitzeri, which has pink flowers that are about, in the old measurements, 2 inches long, that hang off the plant. It also has the purple reverse to the to the foliage. They're fabulous plants, and most of them are turning out to be far more cold hardy than I was expecting.
Excellent.
And great in a hanging basket. And as we all know, space becomes more and more precious in our gardens.
It does.
So if you can whack something in a hanging basket, you've got a new habitat.
You've got another niche. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, just listening to you both talk with so much knowledge about the plants, and I was thinking about, you know, in our program, we're thinking about people gardening in increasingly small spaces or needing to be able to move the way that you have, Stephen, you know. And I just wondered, like, if you were going to give advice to someone who wanted to get beyond the kind of large commercial nurseries, wanted to have more diversity and start to build this lifelong kind of journey with interesting plants, do you go to the plant sales? Will people at the plant sales or the nurseries, will they be able to tell you what you can do in pots and help you, like, become your kind of
partner? As long as you go to
partner?
A proper nursery. And we have to protect them. They're disappearing.
Oh, thanks.
It's really frightening. I think Poynton's is the next. It's being sold up for development.
They've got a 2-year, 18-month sort of exit strategy.
Yes, process. And you know, there's only a handful of suburban nurseries certainly left now, independent nurseries. But even when, I mean, I remember as a kid going to the Dandenongs and there was a nursery under every damn tree.
Yeah,
I mean, it
every
was
400 metres to be a different grower.
And they were all doing something different. And, you know, there was the old Dutchman there growing their rhododendrons and azaleas and burlap sacking them, and you'd buy them in a brown bag, you know, and there was all sorts of really interesting things being grown in small quantities. But those nurseries are slowly disappearing, and I have to say to people, I get quite annoyed if they go into a nursery and they buy something and they've not got the technical support behind them because the staff or the people who own the place don't know. I say to people, if you ask about a plant in a nursery and the staff member picks out the label and reads it to you, leave.
Yeah.
You know, you need to have that background support.
Yeah.
I'll even tell people what to do with the plants they bought at Bunnings if they come in and ask me the question. Grate my teeth a little bit, but nonetheless.
But they're there with you.
Yeah.
So that's important.
Yeah, as long as they walk out with another plant. But, yes, you've got to protect that sort of thing and also engage with the specialist societies. Yeah. Again, they're disappearing.
Correct. Yep.
I mean, we lost the Fern Society a few years ago, so we don't have a specialist fern group out there. But we've got bromeliads, we've got African violets, we've got pelargoniums. I mean, there's oodles of specialist groups and societies out there.
The Australian Plant Society.
Yeah, the Australian Plant Society. So if you have a passion for a particular group, find the specialist group out there, the Begonia Society, all those people.
All those people.
They're all out there.
Kate, I think places like the Ferny Creek Flower Shows and the Bolobecs and, you know, some of those sort of next tier garden fairs and garden shows, I mean, that's where you'll meet the growers.
Yeah. That's a very good point.
Because I think at Ferny Creek the other day there was like 30 independent specialist growers.
Right.
Which is great. You know, there's a lot of effort goes into putting those on. So I agree, though. They're the locations where the environment is to support the smaller nurseries or independent nurseries.
Mm.
So therefore, there's a wealth of knowledge. You just and you know, as gardeners, we're all happy to chat. So you just need to go up and chat with them and go, I like that plant. What can you tell me about it? And then the growers
you set them off.
Just buckle up.
Now we've got a call come through, so I want to get to that. So it's John from the Friends of Melton Botanic Gardens. So let me just get through. John, are you there?
I am here.
Great to hear your voice.
I've been chucking away with the conversation too.
Excellent. Thank you for holding on as we were chatting away there. Great to have you. What's been happening with you?
Oh, lots have been happening, of course. But I'd like to see if I could please take some of your time to update you on the activities and developments of the Melton Botanic Garden that have been done by the Friends. Well, probably firstly, and this is about every botanic garden, is that from the 18th to the 24th of May, it's National Botanic Gardens Week, and that's Australia and New Zealand. So during that week, and it is about getting into your botanic garden to understand and experience health benefits that botanic gardens and nature brings. So we've got a nature sketching workshop on the 24th of May. That's a Sunday.
Yeah.
You do have to book in, and we have nothing like nature. Dr. Kathleen Baggett, who runs that, is terrific. She's run quite a few workshops for us now and done lots of things at different gardens across Melbourne. So if you look up Nothing Like Nature, you'll see the booking site there, and that's free. So you don't have to pay for anything like that, and you get 2 hours, a little bit of nature bathing and then nature sketching and things like that. So it's a great workshop. We also have on that day our Grow the Garden Day, and from 10 till 12 we'll be doing some planting and finishing about 11:30 and having a good cup of tea and cake together. And on Friday the 5th of June, which is World Environment Day, we've got an Indigenous weaving workshop led by an Indigenous, our First Nations person.
Okay.
And you book that through the Melton Council Library site. So there are a few things, and it's also National Volunteer Week coincides with Botanic Gardens Week.
And National Reconciliation Week, it's a big week.
Yeah, and I think it's about getting out there and just trying to volunteer and experience volunteering. So we're always open to having volunteers, and everyone's most welcome. But I noticed you had mention of Olive Festival, and so Melton, and we've, through our media sites, have promoted the taking your olive groves to the Melton location that they've got.
Excellent.
And sorry, taking your olives, yeah. But this week we've installed olive grove signage, so we were fortunate to get a $500 donation from CWA Owls Group. And Paula, one of our volunteers, designed all the sign information signs for each of 13 olives. We've
Brilliant.
Got about 17 in there. And the main sign, and we've had those planted, and the group I head up, the Odd Jobbers, installed them in the ground this week, so they look really good. And we've had the bobcat in, and we've had an area where there's a little group. They don't fit our overall collection theme, but they're a group of about seven Petunia robustas that were planted in the 1980s or 90s and have just been allowed to grow naturally. And I tell you what, they're a really good drought-tolerant tree, but they form this nice round shape. And a couple of years ago, we saw a wedding in there with the bride came down from the car park over the bridge and along the path and into the between the middle of the Petunia robustas, and there was a lovely little white wedding in there. So we thought,
oh, brilliant!
Oh, why not make that a wedding lawn? So we finally
the nimbleness,
everything into an advantage.
The nimbleness of the Melton Botanic Gardens. It's yeah, just
and there were rocks sticking up, holes in that area, and I thought, well, we need to do something with that. So we got the bobcat in and leveled that off a week ago. And so we're looking now to put probably Microlina stapoides in there, the local indigenous grass.
Nice.
We've got that growing nearby, and it is lush and green. The cooch will probably come back through there, but we'll see what we can do. So that's going to be a really good opportunity. And then our latest big adventure is the start of the Children's Experiential Garden. And we've had five large brachychite rupestris relocated from the Caroline Springs Library, right, where they were blocking the art windows and things. And that's been really good. And we've had the bobcat in and done the path network. So now we start the tree planting and things. But it's that experiential garden is... We didn't want plastic and things like that in there. It's about getting in there and experiencing the plants and playing with them and all that sort of stuff. So you can imagine salmon gums in there,
nice,
Malleucas where you can peel the paper bark off, putting branches and things in there so you can create things. So there's little activity spaces. There's a snake path through the middle that ends up at a small labyrinth in a circle of Cuperus sempervirens, the pencil pines.
Wow.
So they've been quite...
What's happening there?
Lots happening.
yeah, and then just nearby you can look up and see the Mexican wave. So from up Stevens Way, there was a lot of storm damage a couple of years ago, and the Melton Botanic Garden was used as a place to stockpile a lot of the trunks.
Yep.
And they've been used across nature play spaces, and we put one in the Californian garden, and one of our volunteers, Pamela, has painted it white, and now she's put different bright Mexican colours in waves running along this big log at the top of the hill.
So it's fantastic.
Bright. So we decided to name that artwork the Mexican Wave.
The Mexican Wave.
Brilliant.
Yeah, and the West Australian, because the gardens now, we started planning out the West Australian, South Australian garden back in 2015, and for a lot of the shrubs, as Australian natives, we do a replacement program at least every 5 years to,
yep,
to make them look good. So the gum nuts group are in the middle of doing that. And I noticed yesterday Stephen was talking about bulbs and corns and
autumn. Oh, yes, flowering in the autumn.
Mm-hmm. And our South African garden looks really good. Same with the Californian Central South American garden. The perennial bed looks terrific at the moment. And the little cyclamens are popping up in the olive grove, so they're really nice. and the species Gladiolia coming out. So they're about to burst into flower, and they're quite spectacular.
It sounds like no one has had this on their list to go and see, that there's lots to see at the moment at the Melton Botanic Gardens.
It's a remarkable garden. And just on Botanic Gardens Week, 3CR's got a dedicated show on the 24th of May.
Yes.
And it is Chloe with Richard Barley, former RBG Melbourne and Q. I'm going to roll up Tex Moon from the Cranbourne Gardens and the Dandenong Rangers formerly, and Amy Downey. And Amy Downey from the Royal Botanic Gardens of Victoria. She's just won an International Plant Conservation Award.
I did notice that. That's
For her work on escarpment gardens.
So what's the collective term for a whole pile of directors of botanic gardens?
Yeah, no, that's a good one. on the 24th, we've got a whole show dedicated to to celebrate Botanic Gardens Week.
So I know you'll be listening in, John, so that'll be one to tune into as well.
Yeah, you've just reminded me that we booked up Alicia Muldowney, who's the curator at the Williamstown Botanic Garden, so she's speaking at our meeting on Wednesday night.
Excellent.
And to finish off the sort of Botanic Gardens theme, we've got Richard Barley speaking at our June meeting on the projects at Kew when he was there.
Excellent. Well, John, that sounds like there's lots happening there, and thanks for sharing that with everyone. All the best with it, and enjoy Botanic Gardens Week.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity. It's wonderful.
Brilliant. All
right. Have a good one. Bye.
All right, hold, Stephen. That's it. Well played.
Welcome back, everyone.
That was a lot of buttons.
Checking my buttons and getting... Now, Stephen, there's a couple of text messages that have come in that talking about things that we were touching on then.
Yeah.
One was about the Fieldia.
Yeah.
Hello, panel. Great show. Thank you. Can you say where you can get Fieldia?
Well, I'll have some in due course. I put some cuttings in a few weeks ago, but I haven't got any in pots for sale at the moment.
What timeline will...
Look, all things being equal, I never like to count my chickens because you're never sure when you put cuttings in what's going to happen. But they're generally easy to propagate. So I would say by late spring I'll have young plants in 3 or 4 inch pots, something like that, of Fieldia. I know I've got a couple of people in my order book for it. Because anybody who's a Gesneriad nut likes to have one or two Australian representatives in their collection, so it's a small group.
Do you grow Fieldia on tree fern? Or?
I've got it growing on an old tree fern stump in my nursery.
Nice.
It seems to do quite well, although I noticed the other day when I went in to get some cuttings that there's some tree fern seedlings or spallings that have come up in the trunk, so I might have to take some of them out just to sort of make some space for the Fieldia. Yep. Because they're popping up all over the place.
Excellent. Now, we've got another text message in here, another one for you, Stephen. Can you tell me where we can take cuttings of the Calocarpa? Do you know that one?
Calocarpa is the beauty berry, which is a shrub from Asia and North America. There's some North American species as well. They're grown mainly for their ornamental berries. Some of them have very good autumn foliage as well.
Purple berries?
Mainly purple, but you can get white-fruited ones. But they're mainly in this really quite interesting shade of purple. And, I mean, there's plenty of red and yellow and orange berries out there, but there's not that many violet and purple ones. So they do stand out really well. I would always do cuttings of Calocarpas as semi-hardwoods in midsummer with a little bit of mist spray or, you know, a humidified environment, and they strike quite quickly. Especially if you've got a little bit of bottom heat under them, they'll strike within about 3 or 4 weeks.
Excellent.
So that would be the best time. The home gardener that doesn't have any of those that equipment might try doing them as winter cuttings, just putting in a few dormant cuttings in the winter. Yep. A lot of those deciduous shrubs will strike that way. I normally don't do that, though, because it's much slower.
Yeah, okay. Great. Yep. Now, Kate, I'm very interested to know what's been happening with the program and what events are coming up, because I know there's a lot of events that get run through. Mm. So what's happening with the program at the moment?
Oh, thanks, Stephen. So the program list, we had a huge weekend last weekend. I think there were 5 events on Saturday and Sunday. Wow. A lot focused on actually composting for small spaces and apartments and things like that. So the resources will be going up online very soon for those, because we always try and put things up.
Now, just to jump in, online,
mysmartgarden.org.au.
Excellent.
Yep. We're really becoming very interested in making it clear how people who are in smaller houses or smaller properties or apartments and temporary accommodation can get involved as well. We know we've got a huge demographic of people that own their own garden, but we're seeing from the data that we're getting an increase in people with small or very small gardens
or
and
apartments.
People who are first time. Exactly. Mm. And with the densification targets that are facing a lot of our councils, whether that's vertical or some of the newer suburbs out in the Wyndham area, the availability of space for gardening is smaller, but it doesn't mean it's impossible. And so that's what we're really focusing on increasingly. So we have Chloe Thompson teaching another excellent class for us coming up in the middle of May, Gardening for Small Spaces. She taught she taught one at the Footscray Community Garden for us in, I think, March last year, and there were 80 people showed up on a 35 degree day.
And the response from that was,
it made us realise maybe we need to offer them more often because it's hard to teach for 80 people. Yes,
correct. That's a big class.
It's a big class, so that's coming up in Moonee Valley in the libraries there. So growing from seed, we're always trying to plan ahead for what people need to know in time to do something about it. So in addition to all the olives to oil events, we've got growing from seed, gardening in small spaces, and then Emmeline Bowman's doing a designing your native nature strip.
Nice.
Maribyrnong has just released it's changed its nature strip permit requirements so that it's much easier to do nature strip planting now. And my colleague has just helped the open space team do a really beautiful native nature strip or native planting guide for the Maribyrnong area. So that's been released on the Maribyrnong City website as well.
How wonderful.
Yeah.
There's quite a few 3CR people that are running programs and writing bits and bobs for
Absolutely.
My Smart Garden.
Yeah. Well, we really want local experts to be the ones teaching, and we want them to be able to go and meet people. So, you know, we get Karen Sutherland and Kat Labors, of course, and Emmeline and both the Chloes. And one of the things we're trying to work out is how to help more local experts become experts and start to teach as well. So that's something I'm lucky enough to have Kieran Dixon working at Hobson's Bay for the next 6 months.
Nice.
And as you probably know, he's a pretty experienced educator in the space. And so he's looking at how we can basically build a program where My Smart Garden can help people become paid educators as well. So it's very, very, very early days.
Okay, yep.
But it's one of the things that's made possible by being a council partnership where you wouldn't necessarily feel like it was worth the effort to do a program, you know, and all the governance and, you know, structure, like the insurance structure and the payment structure. You wouldn't necessarily find the time to do that if you were at one council. But if you've got 8 or 10, then you can scale it across. You can put the effort in is like the returns are exponential because all of a sudden everyone learns from each other. And that's a really interesting model for making the effort to understand what the barriers are for things that we all think make sense.
It's kind of duplicate, don't replicate.
There's a great model that I learned years ago. It's from Margaret Wheatley in the Bacana Institute, and it's talking about scale across rather than scale up, you know, and that community learning. And the book's called Walk Out, Walk On, and the premise is case studies from around the world of where top-down service structures fail, where communities mobilise together to take action, you know, cleaning up their neighbourhood, reinvigorating a community park, teaching each other how to do bicycle-led water pumping systems. It's an extraordinary thing. And I was just thinking about you and listening to you talk about the different botanic gardens. I always forget, because they seem so structured, that they are a community. We're interdependent. Every time I come on this program, I remember how interdependent we are and how important it is that we all keep showing up and doing what we do.
Correct, yes. Mm. And not get caught up in siloing. Mm. And just going, this is just what our environment is and this is what we do. But as in, increase
and the connections. And remember that what you contribute does make a difference. Mm. You know, sometimes it's easy to forget, but you know, listening to you talk, John, about reinvigorating that botanic garden, it's so important.
So important.
Yeah.
And it just putting my botanic garden hat on, it botanic gardens have got a role to play, and absolutely interested in that sort of outreach you know, function and role, yep, and facility. Mm. Yeah, I think the very great botanic gardens are ones that are community hubs.
Correct.
Yeah. Mm. You know, Stephen's the... if I could just indulge Stephen for a sec. You're the patron of the Geelong Botanic Gardens.
Yes. Well, the Friends Group.
The Friends Group. Yeah, the Friends of the Geelong. Sorry,
yeah,
Stephen.
Yeah. Yes, apparently I've got to an age.
unofficial patron of the show too, I think.
Yeah, well, maybe. But yeah. I'm also patron of the Royal Horticultural Society of Victoria too. So
you have a bit of patronage.
Yeah, and it's actually a doddle of a job because you show up for the occasional event and that's about all you have to do, and be some sort of weird figurehead. So, but, you know, it's all part of the fun of getting engaged in horticulture, mm, whatever level you can.
Yeah, yep.
You know, so, you know, if somebody asked me to be patron, I take it as a huge compliment. And if they think I'm worthy of being a patron because my name is well enough known that I cause some sort of flow-on effect, well, fabulous.
Yeah,
you know,
great.
That's really, really good.
Yeah, well done. Mm. It's an honour to be asked, but it's also, you know, it's to be committing time to it and putting your name to it. Yeah.
And you do have to commit some time to any of these things you get engaged in. Mm. And having been involved in volunteer organisations like our local Horticultural Society since I was a 10-year-old, yeah, you commit yourself to these things and it becomes part of your normal day-to-day existence. You know, people say, yeah, oh, how do you have time to do that? And you think, well, why wouldn't I have time to do that?
Yeah.
You know, that's important to me. It's part of my ritual and my daily routine is to get engaged with whatever that is.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's really important.
Stephen, I remember you speaking at a botanic garden conference once, and the thrust of what you were saying is if you're asked and you've got the capacity, you should say yes.
Yeah.
You should say yes.
So one thing I learned from my dad is always say yes.
Default to yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
But that being said, one thing I agree with that. But I think it's also working out determining your own individual yeses and your noes.
Oh yeah, you do have to learn how to say no as well.
That's right.
Because you could say yes to everything, but then you go. And I've often referred to this in the context of creatives, whatever form that may be, are often the ones get to. Asked to come and help and do things for other organisations or to music or whatever it might be. But if that actually, often they'll say, we collectively say yes. But what can happen in that is that you then don't get the time to do your yes. Creatively.
Stop looking at me, Stephen.
I didn't. You had the fingers pointing at yourself.
Yeah.
But it's a mirror. It's very much a mirror because we all do it.
Oh, yeah.
Because we're, you know, that's the nature of who we are. So
it's like anything in life, you do have to pace yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's like anything else. I mean, it's like donating to organisations. You can't just keep donating money to everything because otherwise you then need somebody to donate to you. So you end up in that position. So you pick and choose the things that you're going to support.
That alignment thing.
Yeah. And, you know, you have your specific charities that you support and that's good. But there's, you know, there's a limit to all these things.
Yeah, true. Yeah. So, yes, not taking away from what you said, John, but just adding a little extra bit. And we've got a couple more questions that have come in through the text. We have a question about proteas and banksias.
Mm-hmm.
So looking for some advice on whether you can grow them in pots. Got some from my daughter for Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to everyone.
Oh, yes, it's Mother's Day today. Yes, so silly us. We didn't
Mother's
say
Day and plant mums, whatever that may be, for each other. But don't have much space in the garden. So interested to know how well they can go in pots by the sounds of it.
Yeah. No reason why not.
No.
I mean, some of these bigger growing ones may have a comparatively short span in a pot.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a matter of picking and choosing. I mean, there's quite a lot of compact dwarf banksias. There's some really good compact proteas.
Yeah.
So pick and choose the ones that are likely to last. And I always think of things in pots as being not exactly ephemeral, but not something that I'm always going to have. So you, if I can get perhaps 5 or 6 years and have something in a pot, I'm really happy with that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, sometimes there's things that last a lot longer, but certainly if I had a good protea in a pot and I was getting great value out of the flowers from it, and in about 5 or 6 years from now it became really root-bound, I couldn't put it in a bigger pot.
Time to get a new one.
Yeah, I would pass it on to a friend who's got a garden and let them plant it out and see how it goes and plant another one.
And I think that's the thing too, is that sometimes we have the thought that it's going to last forever.
Mm. Yeah.
I look at it in the context of, well, technically it's Mother's Day, so often what happens is you get given flowers or gift flowers. They last for about a week, but we don't actually then go, oh, my goodness, why don't they last?
Yeah, they're not here still. Yeah.
So for plants, I'm often using that example to say, you know, if you get a year or two or five out of it, great.
Well, see, I would buy one of those Phalaenopsis orchids in bloom and think I was getting enormous value because the blasted thing will flower for months. But why would I then, after it finished flowering, go through all the effort to try and bring it back into bloom again, which will take 12, 18 months, and you've got this scruffy little thing with two leaves on it.
But it's there to remind you that it once flowered and it might still flower.
Yeah, no, you go out and buy another one and that one turns into something useful, which is compost. So I have no problems with that. Plants for me are what you're painting a picture with.
Yeah.
And if the picture's not working, then you need to change the paint.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the upside of that is that, yes, there are lots of Banksias and proteas. I know that Banksia birthday candles, for example, perfect. The small little...
Yeah, it's a good little one.
Yeah,
one perfect. Is great for pots and good size.
Actually,
pots,
I was just given the other day a Protea amplexicaulis, which is one of the small trailing proteas from South Africa, and it has grey-green leaves and it looks like some sort of weird juvenile eucalypt. It doesn't look like a protea at all. And
so
it
what
has
was that
down
one again?
Amplexicaulis.
Yep.
I don't know how easy it is to get commercially. This was actually given to me by a Protea grower as a nice thing to add to my collection of rarities.
Very good.
It might not be easy to get Protea amplexicaulis out there in the trade, but I can remember it as a kid. I got into a protea sort of frenetic phase there for a wee while when I was a kid.
That was your protea phase.
Yeah, that was my protea phase, and I drove all the way over to Protea Flora, which started in about 1975, so that's been going for a long time.
Sure.
I drove over to them and brought back a whole pile of really unusual proteas to our family nursery at Mount Masson. I don't think I ever did anything with them other than plant them, but I enjoyed collecting them, and I remember getting amplexicaulis way back then. But some of those smaller proteas make fabulous tub specimens.
Yep. I think the one of the tricks to container gardening is that, you know, I mean, it's about water and regularity, and because if a pot dries out, if something dries out in the soil, it can put its roots into the soil.
Yeah, that's right. It can keep moving.
It can chase the additional resources. But in a pot, it's finite.
Mm.
So it is about watering and effective watering.
Yeah.
I think on the show last week there was, you know, talk about the hydrophobic potting mix, and you know, you water it but it's just falling through the cracks in the so wetting up your potting mix, keeping it moist, having the right size container,
slow release fertilizer, yeah, something that just gently feeds. You don't want to push something in a pot because then it will outgrow the pot faster. So you just want to feed it gently.
Does my smart garden have a container growing pot growing on the website or anything like that?
We do have some resources, but it's actually something that I want to get much clearer on, and I'm talking to some of our my colleagues around smart sensors and data collection and stuff, because I would love to be able to say to people, you know, if you've got an east-facing balcony and you know we've got 3 days of heat, this is the smallest size. These are all the things you need to do to make sure your garden will survive while you're out at work.
Yeah.
Because it's so, when you've got a small space, you can't afford to make costly mistakes because you haven't got anywhere to get rid of the potting mix or ditch the plants or, you know, it's much harder.
Process of you don't necessarily have a worm farm or a compost heap.
It's not so easy.
On a balcony, you've got to think about those aspects.
You
very true.
You can't piff it down the side of the house.
As some of us
know. Yeah, yeah. Good piff it. It
might be the balcony, but it's not the best for those walking by.
You know, you can definitely jump on our website. We've got a resources section with material that goes back years, and you can search on there for, there is some container gardening stuff. But I would really, one of the things that we're working on this year is making it really easy to find.
Terrific.
Yeah, great. Excellent. just going to recap, we've got a text message from Paul who contacted us last week. Same question, but we've got a different panel this week. So we've
might get a completely different answer as well.
And that's the joy of it. That is the joy of it. We've got different plant collection and experience between the three of you. Mm. So Paul has the issue of struggling to grow plants in the little street garden outside their house in the inner suburbs. The issue is dogs that come past and use it as a toilet. Essentially, Paul's at his wit's end. The question is, do we have any suggestions for plants which may deter dogs from defecating on the garden?
Ooh.
Dog
bane.
Well, that one came up last week, which we initially didn't.
I don't know how effective it is, I might add. I mean, it has a quite pungent smell to it.
It does. We were suggesting some prickly plants, maybe, so that if they do back into it, then they.
Yeah, well, I have no problems with that. It's like when people come into the nursery and something's got prickles and they say, oh, but the kids might get prickle bite. And I say, well, only once.
Correct. Yeah.
You know, that's a learning process. Yep. And I do get annoyed about that because thorns and prickles are useful things in a garden.
Yep.
They give small birds habitat that they can hide from big birds. If you plant one under your bedroom window, it'll stop people getting out.
Or in?
Yeah, well, I was thinking about out probably. At my age, it's keeping them in is the issue. So prickly plants are definitely a possibility because, you know, if a dog's uncomfortable going into that area, so there's lots of, well, in natives, there's lots of grevilleas and things that are slightly prickly that would probably work quite well. There's certainly exotics like berberises and many other plants like that. Rose bushes, dare I say.
Strappy leaf plants?
Yeah, strappy leaf plants seem to be a little less likely to be...
this is a verge planting, essentially. Yeah. So anything in the My Smart Garden backlog or... programs about how to stop dogs.
I have to say, though, I think some of the blame for this problem falls back on the dog owners.
Well, that's what Paul's mentioned in there, and the frustrations
If your dog does something, you should clean it up.
Correct. But we all know that doesn't always happen.
No, well, I know it doesn't always happen, but
I think it's also probably the point of two things: not cleaning it up, but also deterring them from stopping there to start with.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of the pelargonium, the citronellary ones.
Oh, yes, some of the scented ones.
That might be worth a shot.
Yep.
Buy some pelargonium Mabel Grey and
those really pongy ones.
Yeah.
I remember seeing upturned water bottles sitting on lawns.
I think that's for cats.
That's for cats.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure, Paul, there's a bit of a selection there. Hopefully some of those may be of suit.
I wonder also about, it's a bit of a left field one, but you can get those in ground. My mum uses this for her dog poos. It's a composting system that you dig into the ground and then you just put the poop in there and, you know, a bit of sawdust or something.
Yeah, so if a dog's done it, you just rake it into your...
Rake it in?
Basically you're slowly collecting
the only trouble is all the dog owners in the area might start using it.
Well, they might, but it is a really interesting tension about public-private relationships and stuff. And those do change over time. And I think sometimes when we, you know, my neighbours used to always park in my driveway and I could never stop them from doing it. Until I got a car, and now I have a car. They never park in my driveway. It's like
you've substituted.
It's really odd, but that's 10 years of battles. So it's just it does change over time. I guess.
What about motion sensed irrigation system? Oh,
probably going to catch every passerby as well.
Yeah.
Oh no, Eliza just texted in with a potential suggestion. And this is a behaviour management strategy, maybe. It's she says, I wonder... Rosie, from Mount Eliza. I do wonder whether putting out a bowl of water for the dogs and keeping it topped up might deter them from defecating.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
We have such a bowl and have never had dog poo nearby. So that's maybe it's the behaviour thing of I drink here, I don't then poo here.
Yeah. Nice. That's good.
So that's another option there, Paul.
A little bit of dog psychology going on here. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, like that.
I think that wins.
That does. And sorry, I was just checking another. We've got another text message from Peter from Notting Hill saying, during the second big COVID lockdown in 2021, I was searching online for Odontonema.
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 Oh, goodness.
Colostacum.
Yeah.
Turns out a man called Noel in Brisbane had bought one from Jerry Colby Williams, contacted him, and he sent me cuttings. The plant is now finally going to flower for the first time, and recently we met for the first time as he was in Melbourne for a conference.
Nice.
So there's the inspiration and connections.
And fabulous connections that build.
Odontonema, it's at the Melbourne Botanic Gardens. There's a pic here. Yeah. It's got that, it's an acanthaceae thing.
Oh, yes.
Big round
green. Oh, I love that family. Yeah. There's some fabulous things in acanthaceae.
But unusual thing.
Mm.
But good garden plant, grows in heavy shade, dry.
Yeah, dry, heavy shade is one of those things that any plant that will do that is precious.
Oh, that's good.
You know, and most of the nurseries seem to concentrate on pretty potted colour for sunny spots in the garden. And people who come into my nursery and realise I've got a lot of shade-loving plants get quite excited because gardens, as they get older, almost invariably become shadier.
Shady and dry.
And because it's trees and shrubs that are creating the shade, yes, they become dry as well. And we can't always be irrigating, particularly if you've got big shrubs and trees, because they're just going to suck it up anyway.
Yeah.
So you need plants that will cope with it.
Yep.
I think Odontonema was on the Melbourne Growing Friends list a couple of weeks ago.
How cold hardy would it be?
Yeah, very cold hardy. It's a good thing.
I need an Odontonema. Yeah.
We've all got some.
No, yeah, I need right now.
We've given, my goodness, have we given Stephen Ryan a plant?
Oh, no, not another.
Yeah. It's a long drive home.
We have got a question from Priscilla in Pakenham. Suggestions for replacing lily pillies, something to grow to 1 metre in height and to grow with azaleas.
Ooh.
So replacing lily pillies.
And where is she? Pakenham.
Pakenham.
Yeah. Well, some of the lily pillies are far too vigorous and overbearing for a bed of azaleas, I have to say. I mean, it depends on what sort of look you're trying to get, but there's lots of smaller shrubs that could work. If you're going to plant as a hedge, you could look at osmanthus.
Yeah, we could.
Yeah, beautifully scented. Mm.
Yes.
Many of them flowering now. And some of the heterophyllous types only ever really get up to a metre and a half, 2 metres, and they're very prunable. You'd only have to prune them once a year. So you have to be patient.
Slower growing?
Yeah, they are slower growing, but the advantage of slower-growing hedge plants is, of course, once you get them to the height you want, you don't have to prune them as frequently.
Correct.
And that stupid Lanicera natida thing that they were selling as Ozbox years ago, I mean, if you weren't out there every week with the scissors going chip, 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 the blasted stuff would be up and looking scruffy in no time flat. So some of the osmanthus would be a good... And the other thing about the osmanthus is they flower out of sync with most of your azaleas, so they're doing something when the azaleas aren't.
Very good point.
And I think that's always something we should look at, is to try and find something that does its thing at other times. Now, I'm assuming the azaleas are all green-leafed. There's actually a couple of very interesting variegated osmanthuses as well, if you wanted to lighten the colour palette in there with the foliage. Yep. So there's one just called Heterophyllus variegatus, which has a white edge. There's one called Gashiki, which has sort of mottled yellow variegation on the foliage. So that would be my first thought, is something along that line. And I guess another shrub that could be worthwhile looking at, there's a form of Ligustrum japonicum, the Japanese privet.
Yes.
Now, the normal form of it is quite weedy, but there's a form called Rotundifolia, which has nice, round, leathery, dark green leaves and grows in a very compact, slightly irregular cone shape. It trims quite well. It doesn't flower very often at all, and I've never seen it set seed, so I think it's probably sterile.
Yep.
So it's not going to become weedy like the big Ligustrum japonicum can. Could be worthwhile looking at.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of ideas.
Yeah, good.
And maybe in the native space, maybe some of the Westringias make a very, very neat hedge. Not such the look with the azaleas.
Yeah.
So thinking broadleaf evergreen, some of the Corias potentially.
Yeah, some of the Corias might work quite well.
Yeah.
And some of them will trim up quite nicely.
Yeah,
Elba trims nicely.
Oh, Elba's a great hedge.
And still complement the azaleas that are in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a few ideas. So there's plenty of plants out there that you could use. Again, it's just a matter of getting the inspiration of what to look for, because if you go into the average big garden centre or barn, they're going to throw yet more lily pillies at you, probably. Yeah. Or dare I say, Petosporum James Stirling.
Or Choisya or Maria. Yeah. And you know, maybe
Kate
some less.
Shaking your head there.
Psychostemma? Yeah. No, Psychostemma. Psychococcus.
Oh, Psychococcus. Yes, that's another possibility.
Yep.
Fabulous winter-scented flowers, good glossy green foliage, not overly sun-loving. But the azaleas would be in the same boat, I'm assuming. So if they're happy and growing well, then Psychococcus should do quite well there. And there's very small ones that only grow to probably, I don't know, 30 centimetres or so, up to sort of metre and a half shrubs with that group. So so they could be worthwhile. And dare I say it's brought up another thought. Ruscus.
Ruscus.
Yeah, Ruscus aculeatus. Oh,
yes. Yeah. Or hypoglossum?
Or hypoglossum.
That's lower. Sorry, not probably not so many. Yeah. Sorry, that's one of my little favourites.
I grow one that's a hybrid that Don Teese found somewhere, which is a hybrid between hypoglossum and aculeatus.
Oh.
And we're calling it Shady Character. Well, Don thought of Shady Head or Shade Hedger or something. I said, that doesn't sound particularly good. So I think Shady Character is a far better name. People will remember it. So lots of nursery people should be given training on how to name plants.
Yes, there's a skill in that.
Oh, yeah, some of the botanical names out there are just so woeful.
Correct. But then again, I've seen some common names where you go, oh my goodness, how did you name that? Like, what were you, was it late at night? Or after a long day's work?
Or three quarters of a bottle of red wine. So we're calling it Shady Character now. It gets to about meter and a bit. It's very vertical.
Yep.
And when the new shoots come up from below the ground, they're purple. And the foliage isn't as prickly as aculeatus. So it looks a bit like a big leafed or big phylloded aculeatus, but it's not as prickly. So you can brush past it without it biting you.
Very good.
And it's a lovely plant, but I think your Mina Rare Plants is probably growing it. I grow a bit of it, but it's not out there. So it's going to be really hard to find. And I haven't really built up enough of it yet to have a quantity to sell to people as a hedge.
Yeah, good.
But hypoglossum I can do. That's easy.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, we have zoomed along for today's show.
Oh, God, it's over already.
And it has been a delight. I want to thank each of you for being very supportive and very conversational. And so thank you to Kate, to Stephen, and to John. It has been wonderful. I have felt supported in my learning and first hosting. Yes, thank you for coming in. Wish you three very well for your afternoon or late, and interested to know what you're going to be gardening. So, that could be a whole other show, but so let's not go there just for today, but wish you well in your gardening this afternoon. Really want to say thank you to our listeners today for listening in and appreciate you being part of the show. We couldn't make this happen without our wonderful producers. Today we've got Bern and Di, so applause to you two as well. We just also want to thank our social media team, Liam and Daniel, that keep putting up things. Stephen, we'll get some photos of
There's already, I've sent those off to Daniel.
Oh, you are
I did
well
that
organized.
Yesterday afternoon.
Well,
so
place, Stephen.
The images of the plants I talked about today will be up there or may already be up there. I don't know. But anyhow, yes, I sent him the pictures yesterday. So I'm trying to be organized.
Well done. Well done. So, yes, to each and every one of you out there listening, we are indebted to you being part of our show.
And can I just jump here, here, Stephen, and say for a maiden show behind the jump, did very well.
Oh, thank you.
So,
some of us have done it before, and we know what.
I'm not sure who you're talking about.
I'm an esteemed company, and know that it can go awry very quickly.
Yes,
we wish you all the very best in your gardening pursuits. Now, the one thing I wanted to mention just before we do finish off and sign off is we are in May, but come June, there are two things for 3CR. We have our radiothon at the end of the month, so please be keeping that in mind. And the other thing is that we are celebrating 50 years. So 50 years, we have an event coming up for you all to be putting in your diaries now. It is on Saturday
the 4th
of July at Collingwood Town Hall, which is in Hoddle Street, Collingwood. So just pop that in your diary and we'll have more news on that as we come to that.
great opportunity to come and say good day to the 3CR Garden Show panel, or those that can
come along. Yeah, you can see why we've all got great faces for radio.
Yes. So thank you very much. We wish you all the very best in your gardening for today and for next week until you tune in to us again next weekend. So thank you very much and have happy gardening.
If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.